Hi everyone, Justin Bell here on Life with Legends. So, I doubt there is a corner on planet Earth where the name Mario Andretti wouldn't be met with recognition. He is, in every way, the definition of a legend. One of only two drivers to win in Formula One, NASCAR and IndyCar, as well as countless victories in midget and sprint car racing. As of today, he is still the last American to win a Formula One race in a career that cemented his legacy as one of the most successful drivers in the history of the sport. Now, of course, he's a brand name involved in current racing as well as a winery and multiple entertainment centres, so it would be easy to forgive Mario for losing connection to his humble origins. But that simply isn't the case. When I went to his house, he was welcoming, kind, and generous with his time, and I felt truly privileged to spend the afternoon with him. I love taking his portrait, and I think you'll see it. There's a twinkle in his eye that reflects his love of life and his deep and never-ending passion for racing cars. This is a special one. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did.
All right. You know, it was funny on the way here. I was thinking, I've done a million interviews with a million different people. And there's some people that you're more, it's not nervous about doing it in front of, but you're like, I really want to, you know, be myself and get here. And, you know, I am who I am and the way I do it. But I actually, do you remember John Morton?
Yes, indeed.
So last week I went and did John. Oh. And he said, because, you know, He's a guy that was faster than his name would suggest, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, he was one of those guys that drove really well. But I was
Can-Am,
I was unashamedly, I said, just so you know, you're my crash test dummy for Mario with my new equipment. And he was like, that's okay. I'm okay with that. So, geez. I said, thanks for having me here. It was one of those things that when I said I was to my dad I was coming here, who says hello, as I said. He was like, I've never been. I mean, where are you going again? Nazareth, Pennsylvania? Yeah, and I said, yeah. Good. My kids are like, where are you going again?
Yeah. Well, at least he said Pennsylvania. He didn't say Israel.
I know. No. That's true. That would have been even worse.
There's a Bethlehem.
I saw that on the sign as well.
From here.
I mean,
so you're in a holy land. But anyway.
What does that make you? It's the Holy Land. What does that make you? So let's go back. You, as you said, you were how many years in the?
Well, we came to America in 1955.
Yeah,
and I was 15 years old. Twin brother Aldo, 15 as well, obviously.
Yeah,
and it was actually my sister's birthday when we were just sailing by the Statue of Liberty, 5 a.m. on a beautiful June day.
Yeah.
June 16, 1955. It was actually quite the moment. But anyway.
And you remember that?
Oh, vividly.
Really?
Absolutely. We were on the bow of the ship, and my sister had learned the American National Anthem, so she was blurting away.
No.
Yeah.
I imagine that that's the kind of thing that will stick with you.
Forever.
Forever, right?
Yes, indeed.
Do you think those moments are more deeply rooted because of the trauma beforehand?
Indeed, of course. I mean, this was the unknown. You know, we were venturing into the unknown. Yes, well, we had some relatives here, but going to America, even when the visas were finally approved 3 years after my dad applied, my dad said, well, he said, I guess we're going to America and maybe for 5 years and then come back, just so to soften, you know, the blow, if you will, because it was the unknown, you know, it was the promised land, if you will, which it became exactly that and more, you know, but the unknown. And, you know, we were a product of the war, you know, unfortunately, you know, that we lost everything during the war, because our region was ceded to Yugoslavia, hardline communism, and the choice was to succumb to that or leave. Jeez. And we were refugees in our own country for 7 years, 7.5 years.
As you get older, do you, probably when you came of age and you had your own kids, you probably realized and only appreciate what it was like for your parents. Because you were kids with that, well, it's an adventure, but they must have been through hell.
But that's, you know, the responsibility. Like my dad kept saying, your future, your future, your future. I'm only doing this because of you kids. You know, you have a whole life ahead of you. And, you know, in those days, you know, he was only in his 40s and he, you know, he felt, well, it's, you know, I'm at the end of my life. You know, he lived to be 90. But nevertheless, you know, it's
that. But back then, back no one lived to 90. I mean, it was a rarity. He was right.
Yes, indeed. But anyway, it was a blessing, obviously, what happened. And I always look back, Justin, so many of the so-called negatives becoming positives.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is certainly one of them. And, you know, even, you know, years after being here and so forth, things going well, my dad was still recalling, I said, you know, back when I and my friends, this and that, I said, Dad, I said, you know, Marshal Tito, you know, Yugoslavia, we should put him on our Christmas card list. I said, because of him, we're here.
Yeah.
And look what's happening to us, you know, the kids, the opportunities. Because I fell in love with the motor racing when I was there, you know, that the early 50s, you know, a prominent the sport, the Formula One was in,
totally.
In Italy.
Emilia Emilia.
Ferrari, and, Maserati, Alfa Romeo, and then world champions at the time. And, you know, Ascari, Taruffi, Castellotti. I mean, you go on and on and on. And so I fell in, I don't know why, but just was attracted to the sport along with my brother.
Just right from the minute you saw a car, because where was the first ever racing car that you saw?
On the video, you know, like actually we would go to the movies.
Okay.
And then they would have newsreels and, of course, prominent, you know, the sport, you know, the calcio, you know, soccer and so forth. But automobile racing was the first one. And, of course, they would show races in Argentina, wherever, you know, the Grand Prix would go. And then my absolute idol became Alberto Ascari.
Yeah.
You know, and that time world champion. You know, he was killed like a month, 2 months before we arrived here. But anyway, we saw... We were hanging out in a garage next to where the camp was, if you will, which was inside the city of Lucca. And and we befriended the owners, you know, and they used to let us park cars.
Yeah,
you know, they were parking garages as well and doing burnouts.
And how old were you now?
I was then like 12 to 14.
12, okay.
But at 14 years of age, he took us to Monza to see the Italian Grand Prix. And the mold was cast.
I mean, that was it.
The dream. I said, from here on, in my own mind, there was no plan B. You know, and you know, when we arrived there in June, full season on. Yeah. Then, in the local racetrack here, we arrived on a Thursday. On a Sunday night, we were hanging about my uncle's house there, and we see bright lights in the background. Aldo and I looked at each other, and it was an explosion of engines.
Yeah.
All of a sudden.
Yeah.
And I said to Uncle, I said, what's going on? She said, oh, they have this noise, the race car. Wow. We just booked, followed the noise, and saw the modified stock cars there on a half-mile dirt track. And
I mean, as different from being at Monza. Than you could ever be, but the same spirit, right? The same.
Yes, but you know what? You know what was the bright side? It looked very doable to us. Monza looked like a million years away and all that.
Good
but
point.
Here it says 2 years after, we start at age 17, we assembled four other buddies and we started building a car to race here.
Jeez.
That's how it all started.
I mean... It's funny, you know, when I went to Monza why did Dad and I go there? Maybe, well, the Monza 1,000 kilometers.
1,000
kilometers,
so,
So I was there, and I'm 12, I'm probably the same age, 14 years old, and he wanted to make sure that I walked down that middle part where all the trees are in, like, the park. And the
park, yes.
He said... You've got to. He said, "You can feel it, that JB. You can hear the noise of the heroes of the past, and even though there were no cars moving at that point. He said, just listen. And yeah, so for you, it must have been extraordinary.
It's poetic.
What do you remember about seeing, because you did see Ascari Drive, didn't you?
Yes, he was there. He finished third. Yeah. But of course, you know, there was Mercedes was dominating in those days.
Yeah.
It was Fangio, Kling. And, but he fought so hard, you know, with we were just, well, on the berm, you know, now there's some bleachers.
You could be right there.
Bleachers before the Parabolica.
Yeah.
And so, anyway, so he just had that car sideways and everything, raising dust and, I mean, really driving
hard.
He
was
hard.
a strong guy, right? Yeah,
but very calm, you know. Yeah. They used to portray him as he had ice in his veins and
really?
All of that, you know, as a kid, you say, you know,
because
you're so excited and you see them, he's so calm, so cool and collected.
Yeah.
You think, oh, man, that's my man.
That's
you know that I was inducted in the International Hall of Fame.
Mm-hmm.
2 years later, posthumously, I was asked to induct him.
Oh,
can you imagine talking about coming full circle?
Full circle.
And I presented his son, Antonio.
That's crazy.
With the induction plaque.
I love those moments. It's like he would never have known the impact. I mean, I'm sure you... Did you ever get the chance to talk to him about your career and...
No, never. But it's been talked about, it's been written about, that the family, his wife, Marietta, she knew all about, you know, us, myself, you know, being so, you know, so much, you know, having had him as my hero.
Yeah.
And so, obviously... Being inspired.
Inspired.
Yes.
You know, every generation, I remember talking to Sterling about it, and he said, you know, every generation...
But he was another one.
He's
Talk
another
about
one,
Sterling.
Right? The guy.
I mean, he was here again.
Yeah.
You know, a year after I watched him at the Mille Miglia, you know, we were at the Futa Pass and the Abetone, and watched him with Dennis
Jenkins,
you know, there, with his head was bobbling away, going, whoa, and with his Mercedes, you know, going by. So, yeah, he was another one, you know, my hero again. And when I finally got to meet him and Fangio, you know, and I think they were taken back as to how much I knew about their career. Because, and I remember we were in Argentina, and Fangio was really interested in me talking to him because, you know, he says, this young man don't even know about us, you know.
Yeah.
I said, well, I do.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's probably the same for you. Now, as you've taken on that mantle, you're them now.
Yeah.
And the younger guys, you're probably like, why does Jimmy Johnson know about? I mean, he knows about you, but, you know, you obviously... But all these guys...
Yeah.
Being a role model probably was the last thing on your mind when you were you were a kid, right? I mean, who would have ever thought that?
No.
Did you ever? I mean, this is kind of weird question, but when did you kind of go, oh my God, I've become Mario Andretti? I mean, you know what I mean? There's a moment when you're like, you became your own version of folklore at some point. When did you?
Well, there was not a moment, really, quite honestly, because I've been so blessed and fortunate to have a long career. So it took a long time, you know, and things were progressing so well. There were moments where I felt, oh, my God, what if this didn't happen? I mean, you know what I mean,
as far as
opportunity and so forth? Like, oh.
What was one of those? Launch. Was it Chapman when he offered you a drive?
There are moments. But listen to this. For instance, you know, I fought when we built the car to race here. You had to be 21, but the car was ready in 19, so we fudged. We had a local editor of the local paper, Les Young, who befriended, and he changed our birth date on our license and so forth. So Aldo and I, we started in 19, but we were winning.
Yeah,
we started, you know, and I'm telling you, it's a matter of record. Aldo won the very first race, and I won the second race. We crashed. We did all the thing later, but you know, we really had a wonderful first season.
Yeah,
and Aldo got hurt badly on the second season, which basically determined his career. But I went on another year in with our stock cars or won another 24 races. And then, but you know, this, I don't have that in my record because those were unsanctioned events. They were local. I mean, local. We ran three tracks within 150 miles, you know, but they were not sanctioned by any entity. And but anyway, at age 21, I started driving. We bought, I had my future father-in-law. I talked him into buying a three-quarter midget who was driven by none other than Bobby Marshman at the time, who was already a very consummate, you know, IndyCar driver, but he was driving this quarter midget. And with that midget, I won the biggest race of the season, the 100 lapper in Teaneck, New Jersey. Who finished second to me was Len Duncan, who was at the time, you know, one of the obviously icons of midget racing, and that gave me a ride in a full size midget. In a full size midget, a couple of years later, I won three races in one day, three features, and on Labor Day, 1963. And I'm talking about the moments that really made changed. A difference.
Yeah, yeah.
Because at the end of my third feature, Chris Economaki was the announcer.
Yeah.
And I told this a million times, but I got to tell you again. Is on a cool down on after the third feature, which was about 12:30 at night.
Yeah.
Within a 24-hour day, in other words. He says, "Mario," with a shrilling voice.
Yeah. Hey, Mario.
Yeah, Mario, you just bought your ticket to the big time.
Is that what he
said? That's what he said. I'll never forget that. And that propelled me to a sprint car ride in USAC, which was where all the champ driver, you know, Foyts, Branson, McCluskey's, that's where they were all, you know, part of it. And then I win the 100 lapper in Salem, Indiana, high banks, paved track, and here was Foyt was there, and so that all of a sudden a ride becomes available because of injury with the Dean Bandlines, and I'm one of the candidates. And you know, it was between Roger Penske and myself to get the test.
No,
can you imagine? And the test was going to happen in 1964, it was going to happen in Trenton, New Jersey, at a Firestone tire test. And it was between, like I said, Roger and myself, and he talks about it all the time.
Yeah.
But, you know, Roger, he had so many things going.
Even then.
But he was an active driver. And he had a business meeting. He couldn't make it. So all of a sudden, here, I'm the backup. And I'm in there, and I got the job.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I go back, you know, we're talking about the moments in your life, in your career, that make all the difference. What if this and that wouldn't have happened? What if Chuck Koss wouldn't have got hurt?
Yeah.
You know, where would I have gotten a ride? And, you know, in fact, I tell you that this was before Indianapolis. So at Indianapolis, and Clint Bronner was the chief mechanic, so you're not ready for Indy this year. He said, I'll let you, you know, you'll be driving some races, you know, but I want you to keep the rookie of the year status for the following year to do full season.
Okay.
And here I am in Indianapolis, and I got to know Bobby Unser. So he was, he was driving for Andy Granatelli. And Andy Granatelli was had the garage next to Mickey Thompson. So I was there, you know, hanging out with Bobby and so forth. And Bobby goes to Mickey Thompson and says, "Hey, Mickey, why don't you give a WAP an opportunity? Why don't you give me," he used to call me WAP, "why don't you give a WAP a test? He's really good," you know, stuff like that. And so and Mickey told me, "Okay, so tomorrow morning, 9 o'clock, be here, and I'll fit you in a car." Justin, I slept purposely. I slept until 12 o'clock. And I says, you know, Clint Bronner said I'm not ready. And I think he's right. And you know something? I never showed up.
Ooh.
I never showed up. And here's another moment. That's the best decision I could have made in my career. I mean, the cars that Mickey Thompson had at the time had very special, you know, with the 12-inch wheels and so on and so forth. It was kind of weird outside the box. And actually, they didn't do very well in the race. In fact, you know, it was a fatality in one of the cars. But and that would have been the worst thing I could have done.
Yeah.
The following year, however, here I finished third at Indianapolis to Jimmy Clark.
Yeah.
You know, and I get Rookie of the Year. And at the end of, you know, when there's a banquet, you know, the next day, I befriended Colin during the month and Jimmy, as you see some pictures on the wall here. And I said to Colin, I said, Colin, I said, someday I'd like to do F1. He said, Mario, he said, when you think you're ready, you give me a call and I will have a car for you. Justin, can you imagine what that did for me?
You must have, I think about this, exactly the way you're saying it is the way I hoped those moments happen, right? We all have them in our own way, even in my career. But when you say that, I was thinking about the Colin Chapman. I was just thinking about it on the last night. What was it like when he said, and you just, you know, when he offered you that drive?
I think I flew to cloud nine.
Yeah, you must have done. And as part of it, do you think, because in your, yes, you were American, but in your heart, you were European, especially when you were younger.
Yeah,
the thought of going back to race against the Europeans, that must have been very compelling, wasn't it?
Oh, you're not kidding. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the opportunity to do that with a top team and forth.
Crazy.
I mean, and that's when I decided to, you know, I needed to enroll and you know, try to just hone my skills, you know, in road racing. I lobbied like crazy to USAC just to, you know, to have part of the series, some road races.
Yeah.
In 65, there was only one road race in Indianapolis Raceway Park, and I won it. And you know that, that in 63, also there was one road race in Lime Rock, Connecticut with midgets.
Yeah.
Because you know that
way
back, way back in, I think in 58, Roger Ward entered a midget at the Formula One race that was held in Sebring. Look at the stats.
Yeah, I will. Wow.
You know, so we had a midget. There was a midget. I got to tell you this.
Yeah.
There was a midget race in Lime Rock, Connecticut, and actually, the owner, one of the top owners in the series, he had a car, a rear engine car built by John Cooper, with an Offey engine, just to race that race with a 2-speed gearbox. And Mark Donahue drove it, and he's the only race that he drove because he was a road racer.
Yeah, yeah.
And I hounded him the whole race, and the last lap, I passed him going to the straightaway, and it, because he had a 2-speed gearbox, only had in and out 1 speed, and my valve, I had to back off just before the start finish line because the engine would have exploded, and there was no rev limiter. And so the last lap, I just held it in there, scattered the valves all over the place, but won the race. So like I said, you know, my road racing, that was a dream, you know, to be able to. And Eric Brawley gave me my first opportunity in a Can-Am at Riverside. And then Luigi Chinetti gave me also an opportunity at 24 Hours of Daytona. And I drove with Pedro Rodriguez, finished fourth. What I did, I had a great relationship with Ford because, you know, we were fielding the new Ford engine in Indy cars. And the first year, my rookie year in 65, I won my championship, you know, a national championship. Yeah. So it was good. And with the Le Mans program coming on, they needed drivers to do the testing and everything. And I said, I'll do every test, wherever you want me. And that's when I befriended Bruce. You know, Bruce was coming in whenever he could. But Whenever he was there, man, he and I were like that, and I was hanging on to him.
Oh, I bet.
I was like a puppy dog following him everywhere, because then we go to dinner at night and discuss things, you know, because he was such a technical driver that I learned so much from him about, you know, obviously rotating the car and then blah, 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 all those things. And so that's how everything was just happening.
Is that, I mean, and that led, obviously, then, because you had that really famous drive at Sebring, right? Yeah. You know, when
67.
I mean, that's, to me, you know, you just look at the pictures that you talked about, Kinetti giving you that drive in that Ferrari. You look at the Ferraris and the Fords and, at the end of that year into the early 70s, they were monstrous cars. I mean, the tires and the... Yeah. I mean, and everybody was jumping in the big sports cars.
A lot of power,
weren't they? A lot of the Formula One guys, a lot of... No one... There was no segregation, really.
Yeah, it was exactly. I mean, you had the best of the best, driving those long-distance races. You know, that was the beauty of it.
What do you remember about that 67 race? Because it's kind of a bit of folklore, right?
Well, it is because, first of all, again, being part of the development of those cars, this was the first competitive race for the Mark IV.
Yeah.
And which is right behind me on my desk, you know, actually, and again, you know, being with Bruce and so forth, I know I felt very confident. I figured, well, I got to do my job, but I knew the car quite well, you know, which doesn't hurt, obviously.
No.
And we pretty much dominated that race. The competition was the Chaparral for us, and I remember that at least I had the opportunity to race against Phil Hill.
Yeah.
You know, because, my stint was with Phil Hill.
It was. Yeah. It just the timing worked out.
Yeah, we were fighting out. And And I was in front of him when they blew up. I see a plume of smoke. I said, oh, what a beautiful smoke.
It's couldn't happen to a nicer guy.
Nicer guy.
Jeez. He was something else, too, though, wasn't he?
Great guy.
That's the special thing about the memories that you have, whether it's my dad's memories, your memories, Sterling's memories back then, is we all, the fans, know the big moments.
Yeah.
But it's all the moments in between. It was dinner with Bruce McLaren. It's seeing everybody in the driver's meeting, you know, having a chat at the coffee shop. I mean, it was... It must have been special by the fact that you respected and admired these drivers. But you don't think of it as part of history. It was just your life.
No, it was my life. I mean, I was just trying to just learn as much as I could from individuals that obviously were basically could have been my teachers, you know.
Yeah.
They were my superiors, you know. Just like when I broke into the IndyCar ranks in 65.
Yeah.
Who was the measure to go up against? Was AJ Foyt.
Yeah.
5 years my senior, already a proven champion, blah, blah, blah. And those are the ones that make you a better driver. Why? Because you look up there, oh man, if I'm going to go anywhere, I got to be able to compete against this level.
Yeah.
And then it makes you work harder and think and do all the things that you need to do. So. That's why you have tremendous respect and admiration for the likes of these individuals.
Yeah.
Going to Formula One, who was the yardstick there? It was Jackie Stewart.
Yeah.
You know?
What was your first race against him?
Well, it was my first Formula One race was at Watkins Glen, and I was on pole. And who was second? It was Jackie Stewart.
Was there a moment there when you got pole? Did he say anything? Because he must have been, he would have heard about you, he would have known you were a threat coming up, but he was Jackie Stewart.
Yeah, I know.
Jeez.
And he didn't say anything.
He didn't?
Not to me. But and the first race that I won for Ferrari a couple of years later in South Africa, who was second?
Jackie Stewart. Was he really?
And the third race that I won, which was a twin non-championship race in Ontario.
Yeah.
It was twin 100s because they had the Formula 5000 as well competing against the Formula 1s.
Yeah.
And I won both heats. In both heats, he finished second to me. And that's when Mr. Ferrari offered me a drive, a full-time drive in 71, which I couldn't take because of my contracts. And quite honestly, I had to look at the commercial side of it too, you know, like...
You were making a lot of money here.
A lot of money, yeah, I was doing. And I was, you know, Justin, you don't dwell on this, but how many friends was I losing along the way in those years? And you think I have a young family, you got to be thinking of, you know...
Providing.
Providing. Yeah. Providing, mm-hmm. you know, in case something happens. And like I said, I never dwell on that, but you have to be realistic. And I use that as an excuse, you know, refusing, yeah. Tempting opportunity.
What it goes all the way back to when you missed the Granatelli test, really, right? You just in the same way you made decisions not to get in cars.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
That was also a trademark of Jackie Stewart, you know, not yeah. to get in cars. Jackie Ickx too didn't get in bad cars. You just, but the you can't, you didn't dwell on it, but you can't not reflect on it. And for me, it's probably the same as like with Michael, knowing you're, you know, being your son at the time. We knew the dangers that you guys, the number of times I'd go into my mum and dad's bedroom, you know, and or mum would be crying on a Sunday night or Monday morning. And, you know, we're kids. We're just like, okay, I'm not sure why that is. So when people said to me, oh, you just got into racing because of the girls and the money and the cars, I went, maybe if you just read Autosport and that was your only thing. Yeah, but if you're in the family, you know that it's a lot tougher than that.
Oh, gosh, yeah. I mean, of course. I mean, like you said, the other side, the girls, all that thing, that's a caveat.
But yeah.
It's not a motivating factor by any means.
Doesn't mean.
No, no.
Back then, who particularly affected you when they got killed? Who stopped you in your tracks and went, shit?
Oh, I mean, some of my best friends, like Billy Foster, we were like brothers.
Well, yeah.
You know, Canadian driver, we came in, we're rookies together. And he's the one that used to get on me. He said, Mario, he had a beautiful family. He said, you're crazy to doing sprint cars, you know, back in the mid-60s yeah. or so. And then he outside of IndyCar, he was doing stock cars. Guess what? He was killed in a stock car at Riverside. And it was, he and I were rooming together. And he went out, we were qualifying, single car qualifying. I was the next one to go out. And knowing that, and
your buddy,
oh my God, you know, I went through so many moments like that. One of my good buddies, you know, Judd Larson was killed here in Reading. At the same time, there were two drivers killed. Red Regal was killed, the same accident. We lost two drivers. Three races later, in California, I was in that race as well. My teammate, Dick Atkins, was killed. You know, him and Don Branson. Hmm. As you said, you know, the drivers' meetings at the beginning of those seasons, you know, you couldn't help it but look around and say, I wonder who's not going to be here at the end. It was almost like going to war.
Mm.
And we used to, you know, in the sprint cars, midgets, and, you know, in Indica, we used to, in the 60s, 70s, even some of the 80s, you know, we'd lose two, three, four, six. And when I think it was in 64, we lost six guys that season. And it was... yeah, and you know, ourselves, you know, like I say, you couldn't dwell on that, you know, you feel, you know, I'm invincible, it's not going to happen to me and all that. You have to have that attitude. But your wife, you know, you have a young family, and when I came out of the cockpit, it's the only time that I realized the anguish that my wife was experiencing all these years, because here I'm on the sidelines watching my kids, you know, Jeff, Michael.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, when I was on the track, the same, you know, with both of them,
yeah,
I felt like, you know, you have some control, you're doing the same, you know, which is obviously not a reality, no. but being on the sideline, even then, you know, it's much safer, but you always feel like helpless. And I felt, you know, I'm the proverbial nervous Nelly on the sideline today, you know. And so again, you know, when you start thinking of your family, you know, your wife, your best friend, and so forth, what they went through while I was enjoying myself, you know, how selfish, you know, that was, and realizing how good she was for me by not showing that anguish, you know, making me guilty, you know, if you will. She was supportive. She knew how much I loved it, how much I wanted it. She never said, why do you have to do so much of it? Can we have a weekend off?
No.
And, you know, I never said that. And I realized, you know what? What a saint she was for me, you know?
And especially in that era, it was it was a very tight knit community,
yes.
United in the sense of adventure. Traveling, I think the
together,
traveling, the
together,
you'd sleep, the like you said, you'd room with them, you'd
dinner together.
You'd dinner. I mean, now I know the drivers
around,
still do it.
Throwing salads to one another,
yeah,
you know,
right?
And having food fights, you know, in restaurants, you know, having
being, yeah, just having
being
the
stupid,
young having people
fun,
having
you know?
A great time.
Yeah, and then all of a sudden, you know, it's one of us is missing, you know,
yeah.
And it was all of that, you know, and that was the reality. That was the reality of the sport at the time, and you know, luckily we all got smarter and started looking at safety.
Same.
And I look back at how the GPDA started for no other reason than safety, and it was you know, at the avant-garde of that was Jackie Stewart and people
he did
and
do
myself.
A lot, didn't he?
I think I take some credit for that, because from a safety standpoint, I was always in for. In fact, I was even accused of being such a you know, they call it a pussy.
Yeah, yeah,
you know,
right. No, I know.
You know, for having extra, you know, protection around the cockpit and so forth, around my head. You know, I keep saying, man, I want to live to be another, to drive another day, you know.
Yeah.
And so even, you know, with Maurice Philippe, you know, when he built the car in 74, first one that had it, full protection around my head and so forth, you know. And because I was always, my biggest thing was probably not even, you know, part of potentially being killed, but to being paralyzed. And there were so many that had accidents where they were paralyzed. I said, oh my God. I mean, that was my biggest fear.
Was it?
Biggest fear.
Did you and your contemporaries think Formula One was more dangerous or IndyCar at that point?
I think IndyCar was.
It was, right?
For sure. Because of the speed of the ovals.
Yeah, yeah. And the technology
and
of the cars was...
And again, you know, in IndyCar, even the championship when we had, was we had the dirt track races, you know, we had, out of the championship, it was six dirt track races, and those were lethal.
Were they? Yeah.
Those were lethal.
That's where you...
That's before the cages, you know.
Was it really? Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I mean... And, but the way you have to look at it, it's like, I know you had your own viewpoint on Chapman's cars, and but if they could win races and they were fast and they were pushing, I mean, technology always tries to find a way around the regulations. Everyone's pushing as hard as you all wanted to win. If you win, you could be a bigger driver, you make more money and everything.
Yeah,
I mean, it's a tempting thing to get in cars, but. I mean, we look at McLaren had one way of evolving his cars, and Chapman had another. What was it like when you actually got in his cars?
Well, you know, I knew of some of the drawbacks of Chapman car, because even at Indianapolis, there when I won the race, I started this the practice and everything. I was in a four wheel drive Chapman, you know, the Lotus City 3, and the car was fast and everything, but started coming out. I almost killed myself. You know, it was just before qualifying on a Thursday. right rear wheel just sheared, crashed, fire, you know, that's when I had my face burned. Yeah. But Graham Hill and Mike Spence also had accidents with suspension failures before that, not as serious, and then they had to withdraw the car because of that. And then we saw, you know, Jim Clark and so forth, you know, that there were fatalities, Jochen and Rindt.
Yeah.
You know, there was a mechanical fatality that killed both of them.
Yeah.
And when I, quite honestly, you know, when I joined there, I did, that's not what I thought about. But later on, when I got to know the mechanics, you know, like Bob Dance and so forth, and I used to just say, let me know if there's some areas where, you know, you just need to do something, you know, make it a little safer. Mm. Like I refuse to have, you know, this brake pedal, you know, but I'm can't be thinking that, can't think of the metal.
what would it mean? Aluminum?
Very brittle.
Oh, very brittle.
Yeah. Boy, I'm not thinking about it anyway.
Okay.
I said, just let me know about certain things. If you think like suspension, and they were looking after me.
Because that's a relationship, isn't it? That doesn't get enough
attention.
I was looking at it when Lewis pulled out of the garage and the last race. I don't know what made me just think about it. I was watching them in qualifying and they go out and I was watching everybody doing their dance around the car, doing what they do. And I said, you know, someone is the last person to do you up. Someone is the last person to tie the tie clip, you know, the tie wrap, whatever, you know, the little bracket, the... I mean, there's amazing trust that you have to have in, and especially in those days when there were less mechanics, it was pioneering, maybe. Yeah.
Justin, I have friends from the beginning, you know, that you develop that relationship.
Yeah.
You have, to me, so much appreciation, you know, for what they were doing. And they know when you're out there driving your butt off, you know, and if you bring results, you know, they're going to take care of you because it goes hand in hand.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, it became a wonderful family throughout. I mean, I have, you know, like Bob Dance of this world, some of the, they visit me here.
Yeah.
You know, from those days, from
that's
the
great.
70s.
Yeah.
You know, you develop that in IndyCar as well. I mean, these are guys that, you know, they're my age and so forth, and they're still around, still fiddling with cars, and we still communicate, you know, and it's you develop this lifelong friendship, the bond, because of that. Because you drove for them, and you brought some results, and they took care of you.
Mm. No one's ever really talked about that side in the, you know, Beaky Sims strapped Jim Clark in the car that day. He strapped him in, probably shook his hand, and then Jim dies.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a weight to live with, isn't it?
Yeah, Beaky's another one.
He's an amazing guy.
Yeah, we talk. I mean, we worked together.
Yeah.
And those are the types, you know, that... And we developed that relationship that it's lasting a lifetime.
Yeah. So when you did answer Ferrari's call and you go and drive his cars, I was just thinking about, I was looking at a picture yesterday. Was it the 1979 Ferrari? I think it was the Formula One car. That was the last Formula One.
82.
That car is maybe one of the most beautiful cars ever, right? Just the simplicity of it. It was,
but the power with that new turbo,
really
charged engine,
was it
are
amazing?
You kidding? I mean, the qualifying. You know, the qualifying mode on that engine, 1,100 horsepower.
Jesus,
you had about 5 laps in the engine or something. You
really
had to get it done, but because. When I was called, obviously it was dire moments, you know, when I was there to substitute Didier Pironi, who was killed, and it was a terrible year because, you know, that's when Gilles Villeneuve also.
Yeah.
So I was asked to cover in dire circumstances, but here we go. You know, I had been out of Formula One for 2 years then, and 1 year. But the new, you know, the all every engine was turbocharged because Renault came in at first with turbocharged engines, and then everybody had to go in that direction.
Yeah.
And Ferrari, so I said, I need a test in Fiorano. So I did a test, I got familiar with the car, and finally Fergieri said, now we're going to do the, we'll give you the qualifying tune. I set a record that lasted 8 years there at Fiorano.
Holy shit.
And I mean, qualifying, I'm telling you what, I mean, I was getting fourth gear wheel spin in between the Lesmos.
Jesus.
Yeah, because he had downforce, but a lot of it, you know, was a total, a lot of front, because
yeah.
on the front, we used to have wings the opposite to lift the front,
yeah.
because there was so much, you know, in those days, the tunnels were so aggressive that all the downforce was in front, you know.
So they'd be trying to lift the car off the front?
The COP, the center of pressure, was all in the front.
Jeez.
So you had the front wings were like this, lifting the car. I mean, but again, it was just the car was really amazing to drive, you know. But
1,100 horsepower turbos,
yeah.
no traction control,
no
anything. I mean, think about that. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Was it the first time you went into the Ferrari factory to drive, you know, knowing you were going to be a Formula One driver? That was another case of life full circle, yeah, wasn't it?
For sure.
That was...
Well, for sure, you know, just even to win my very first Formula One race in a Ferrari, I mean, talk about a dream.
Yeah.
As a kid coming from Italy and all that, and then communicating with the master directly myself. Yeah. There was no third person. You know, because, you know, after so many fatalities, he just didn't want to hire Italian drivers because he was getting so much criticism from the government.
Okay.
And so he had mostly foreign drivers. So he always had a third person interpreting for him.
Yeah.
But with me, we dealt directly,
yeah.
you know. And,
what was that like?
It was just was daunting.
Was it? Cause he was a
because he was
a formidable
well,
guy.
Yes, and he didn't put that air about it.
Yeah.
But you couldn't help it feeling that way.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, if anything, he was always, he would in so many ways try to put you at ease, you know. But here's the thing, I got to tell you this. When I first met him, it was in 69, and 1,000 Ks driving with Chris Amon.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's Monza is one race that he would go to.
Yeah.
So I'm there, and Chris was always quick, you know.
Yeah.
So, and I'm out there, and in those days in '69, we had a very hard first turn left, and then going up the banking. We used part of the banking, and there was a time to be made through there, you know. And I during practice I stuffed it, but not. Enough, just body work.
Yeah.
During practice, and I said, "Oh my God, I hope I have a return ticket in my briefcase, you know, because I'm going back." And the old man was as they go home, and instead, you know, I'm just crawling in the pits and so forth, you know, with the front all askew, and he was there, you know, with his hand and you know in his vest all the time, and he had a mild smile on his face. And what do I realize that he would never fault a driver for just making some, for pushing. That's why he never, ever faulted Gilles Villeneuve, because Gilles Villeneuve, I mean, he was 110% always.
Yeah.
How many cars did he wreck?
Yeah.
Did Mr. Ferrari ever complain?
No.
He was a true, through and through racer. And so he figured, I was out there balls out, you know. And he said,
he
the
didn't
kid's
mind
crying.
That.
He didn't mind it.
Wow.
And that's, these are the
That's
things.
All right, right?
Yeah.
You must have thought about that when,
said,
with your, you know.
I said, what a man, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know.
What was it like going for dinner with him? Dad said he enjoyed going for dinner.
He'd
pick him up.
He loved lunch.
He loved lunch. Okay, so you go for lunch.
At the Cavallino, yeah. Every time, always, it was always lunch. And
what was your, I mean, these are the things. Remember, you lived this moment. No, none of us did. I mean,
you
did he drink? Did he smoke? Did he always?
No, just some Lambrusco.
Okay.
You know, which is very familiar wine in the area. Yeah. And in fact, when I arrived there, you know, for the test before the Monza thing, my wife and I, we arrived just in time for lunch and so forth. And I was arrived there, I was supposed to, on a Saturday, the week before, and I was supposed to test all day Sunday. And so on, arrived there, like I said, we have lunch, and I had just a teeny quarter glass of Lambrusco and so forth. And then I said, okay, now we go get fitted up. And get fitted up, and I said, I'd like to do a couple of laps. So they get the safety people out and so forth, and I go out and running. I did 87 laps that day. Jeez. And set a record.
No.
After flying all night from the States.
He must have loved that, though.
And I said, give the mechanics a day off on Sunday. Yeah.
That's so fun. No, I met him with Dad when I was 18. Dad wanted to go. I was just started racing, and Dad wanted to go and see him one last time. And we went in the workshop where you signed the tiles back in the day, and the workshop and the mechanic. Still some mechanics, obviously. This is 87, so there were people there. It was amazing experience. And he was, as Dad said, he'll talk through the interpreter, but I swear he knows more English than he lets on. You know, it's like that's so crazy. What did you think of Jackie X? Because he's a great friend of mine. When you first saw him, he was quick as crap.
We had fabulous times together. Yeah. I mean, we really understood each other.
Okay.
You know, sometimes, you know, you have a couple, you know, I want to qualify. I wanted to qualify. Qualifying was really my rodeo, you know, for some reason.
It?
I don't know what it was, but I just wanted to qualify. And he always let me qualify. And, you know, he was as fast as he needed to be, obviously. He was as quick as anyone.
Yeah.
And he never fought me. And physically, we were close enough everything, you know, I used to set up the the cockpit. And, yeah, we're good.
Yeah.
He was so good as a partner, you know, to drive together. Laid back, but you know, just always on, and we won some good races together.
But knowing him and knowing his relationship with Dad, you know, for Le Mans together, all those races in the 956, Jackie, you know, was individually a superstar in his own way, right? He should have been a Formula One champion, life taking you different ways.
Yeah.
So his respect for you, I'm going to see him at Le Mans next year and talk. He must have had a huge respect for each of you, mutual respect.
We do, mutual, for sure.
Because I don't think he let many other people be the qualifier.
Yeah.
I think he was the guy that did that.
Yeah.
Think about that. That's unique, actually.
It was, you know, in so many ways. But we got along so well. I mean, it was like a natural. You know, he and I to be partners, and here again, I just those are beautiful times, you know, when you because you develop this friendship that's forever, you know, with admiration and respect, and this is for real.
Who was the funniest guy you remember? Because, you know, like in our era, not my era, Dad's era, a lot of it was, you know, like David Hobbs was always the funniest guy, you know, but as he said to some of the other drivers, Jack Lafitte was always a great character. Who do you remember was, he's a good, he'll make the party?
There were several. One that comes to mind real quick was Arturo Mazzario, call him the Italian cowboy.
Really?
I did a race. We won the 1,000 Ks in Monza also with the Alfa Romeo, with him as a partner. And it's funny, the first time I was called to drive a factory Ferrari at Daytona, they were testing. And Arturo Mazzario was the first time on a banking, and he was downshifting for the banking. And I get a call from Fergieri, Mauro Fergieri, and he said, I said, Mario, could you come down? He says, otherwise we have to go back without, you know, finish the test. He's not doing a job for us, you know, and so forth. So I went down, and I'm getting fitted up in the cars the night before.
Yeah.
And the mechanics, you know, they don't know that I'm speaking Italian. So they're out there, and they're making some of their own remarks. I said, oh, I said this guy, he's just like a little fag, just like just like Arturo is, you know, and so forth. And I didn't say anything. And so the next day, it was Arturo was there with Mauro. When I would come in and I was speaking with them in Italian, and the mechanics go,
oh shit. That's brilliant.
I never said a word.
That's brilliant. Oh, I always think that's the best, to be able to for them not to know. They should have known by the name, right? They should have worked it out. We joked about it, the girls not being a motivating factor, but it was a colorful time, the 70s, right? The 60s, 70s.
We had so much time, like all of the stupid things that we used to do, yeah. And the pranks that we used to pull on each other. You know, we'd be by the pool at the Calami Ranch in South Africa, yeah. Or something, you know, with Clay Regazzoni he and I really got on, but
yeah.
He was so much fun. The side, like, you know, we'd be there and there would be a waiter, you know, with drinks, and we'd bet, you know, says, I'll give you a 5,000 liter if you just push him in a pool, you know. We used to do stupid things like that. You know, the conversations that were going on, by the pool with all the guys.
Yeah.
We were all buddies, you know, that...
And Kailami worked well, right, because it was a long way away. Yeah, it was like the winter break,
yes,
almost.
Yes, indeed, yeah. Kailami, and I remember... Spent a lot of time in Buenos Aires, you know. Yeah. We stayed at the Sheraton, I remember, by the pool. There was always all the drivers were staying there. And all the stories, you know,
I bet. Going on. I mean, but you were married by then, right?
Yes.
You were young.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So,
I was married, yeah.
I mean,
I didn't mess around.
No, on reflection, of course, there's people that say, if you want to be truly successful, find the right woman, marry her, and you're going to be the biggest you can be.
Yeah.
But racing drivers traditionally didn't follow that advice.
I know.
There was no social media. Like I joked earlier before we started about Jackie saying, thank God there was no social media. But there was no accountability, right, behavior. Yeah, you could just do what... Everyone traveled the world, had a good time.
That's for real, yeah, for sure.
Who was the... I mean, I know who they were, but like Dad said, you know, Francois Sever, and I mean, beautiful, handsome men. Jackie, handsome men.
Yeah.
I mean, he was a good, he was fast, good looking, yeah. Right?
All the traits.
Yeah. Did you get to know him well?
No, I never got to know him because it was before my time. Well, I was in a race, you know, like when he was also as well, you know, in fact, when I broke in. But I didn't do enough races to really get to know him.
Okay, yeah. No, unfortunately, he wasn't there long enough, was he?
You know, because right after that, I think that's when Jackie retired.
It was crazy. Now, obviously, I haven't seen you since Aldo passed, so sorry. You know, obviously, that's terrible. A twin?
Yeah.
A twin is worse than anything, isn't it?
Yes, because we're all one, you know.
Yeah.
We share so many of our early dreams, and you think the same in so many ways. Aldo and I got on so well. I mean, we didn't have to say anything.
Yeah.
We knew what we were thinking, and it was that type of relationship, you know, very light. We didn't have... You know, if we hadn't seen each other for months, we didn't have to say hi, you know, because we always, you know, we've been talking always one way or another. It's it was so sad in so many ways because, you know, and the beautiful thing about Aldo is the fact that he never showed any what about me. Never.
That was going to be my next question.
Appeared to be the victim or wanted to, you know, say, you know, oh man, you're so lucky, I'm not. No, he was always supporting me. He was always on the sideline, always jovial, and it was something to be said for his character, for his man. I'm not sure that I would have been the same.
The same. If you'd had the accident.
If I would have had the accident, I would have seen my brother succeed and, you know, do all the things that we're dreaming about. And I'm not sure that I would have had the same attitude as Aldo. And, you know, when I had, you know, time to reflect, I said, oh, man, what a good kid you know, my brother was.
But he must have also, as you say, quite a testament to his character, but he must have enjoyed also the journey, the American dream, the immigrant dream. I mean, you both lived it. You lived it to its fullest extent, more than...
No question.
Like the poster child for it. But it must have been very satisfying for him to see the family.
Again, I mean, just like, you know, between the two of us, we're accounting for eight race drivers over through the kids.
Yeah, yeah.
And he lived through, like John, for instance, who was the most successful.
Yeah.
He lived through them. You know, he had his own family, his own kids, pursuing what he loved so dearly. And so he got a satisfaction. It was good enough for him. So he felt that he was not cheated in any way.
No.
And he showed that. And to me, oh my God, he showed a lot of character, you know, for being a twin. I didn't think I would have been.
Who could say?
Feeling. I don't think I would have behaved the same.
You don't know. You just don't know.
I don't know.
Do you?
But,
I must tell you, I've actually always wanted to say this, that when Dad was driving with John, and they did well, remember, in the Miller car and everything, they did really well. He was always so gracious, but almost in a apologetically kind way, right? Yeah. John was such a... Yeah. He was so not the dominant force in the room. He was always very kind to me as a young man.
He was a good kid.
He was a good kid, right?
Good.
God, that's someone taken too young, too, as well.
The family that he raised, I mean, just really, really exemplary.
Really?
You know, he's got the two girls. They're both, you know, professional. They're all great educations. There's both in the medical profession.
Yeah.
And young Jared, you know, he's driving.
Yeah.
You know, he's a great kid, you know, and I think John kept him too much in sprint cars and so forth. You know, I think he needed more road race training, I think, early on to be able to engage and get into probably the Indy cars at least, you know. And but anyway, good family, wonderful, wonderful people. And that's the quality that John showed clearly.
Yeah.
And but, you know, the entire family, we were very close, all of us. Which again is, I think that's very precious, as you can imagine, for us.
When you guys came over, there was no concept of a legacy. Your father felt there was. That's why he was giving you the chance. He didn't know what legacy meant, but I'm sure he didn't. You know, he could never have forecast your success, but it's quite a special thing in the as you get older and you realize that billions of people on this planet who won't leave sadly much of a mark, right? It's we're blips in time, moments in time, but you've created a legacy. I mean, I was trying to think, there's not another name, as you know, bigger than Andretti in terms of Andretti karting, Andretti, but it's a household name. Legacy suddenly becomes you, doesn't it? It's not the strategy.
I count my blessings every day. Why? Because I pursue, you know, my ultimate dream, which was a dream forever, more than I could have ever hoped Mm. That had come true for me. And I, the other thing that I look back, my dad enjoyed everything that was happening to us ultimately.
Yeah.
Except from the beginning. But ultimately, yeah. When he started to understanding, you know, why, you know, we were pursuing this. And he used to say to me always, you know, here in America, it's too bad that you have to die. You know,
yeah.
Later in his life, he says, you know, like I would have a, you know, Ford, you know, it would yeah. give me these Lincolns to drive. Then I would buy it at the end and give it to my yeah. dad. And he said, oh, my God, in America, it's too bad that we have to die someday. You know, and that's a great
yeah,
feeling.
It's a great
you know,
way, right?
Because enjoying the moment, enjoying life,
yeah.
you know, and having that appreciation, you know, for what is happening. So, you know, all these things, again, you know, you look back and that's why I feel, you know, again, so fortunate.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, I actually was, I saw Jackie Stewart. I did this with him in the summer and I got the same feeling from him. You know, it's, I mean, Jackie does things his way, but you know, it's a very special thing to probably be able to reflect back and realize that you made an impact, that your family made an impact, that you and your brother from the little, you know, midgets around here could do that. I mean, very special.
Well, if we didn't make an impact, is while we were totally satisfying ourselves,
mm.
you know, that's what it was, and that's why I feel that I owe so much to the sport.
Yeah,
I have so much deep love forever, you know, for the sport. Like you know, people say, "Well, why do you, where everything going? Why does you know, Michael? Why do you want to be in Formula One? Why? Because we purely love it.
You do.
We love it, and if there's a fault to that. You know, we've been criticized, oh, well, you just have a passion. You don't know the business. Yeah, we know a business. That's all we have done. We have lived our entire life, you know, with Formula One being our business.
Yeah, it's got hot. That's crazy.
I'm actually going to switch. With motor racing being our business.
Okay. One second. I'm going to change camera around because this actually suddenly got really hot. So this way, if I make this one you, I'm not so okay. important.
Do I should I put this?
That's fine. Oh, that'll be fine.
That'll be fine.
Yeah, I can still make it. Sorry about that, guys. Because these little batteries, because it's shooting so high, it does it. I'll just talk. Yeah, I mean the passion for it. That's like when you talk to anyone. It's like why question why Roger Penske does what he does. Why? Still, he doesn't need more money. He couldn't. He's one of the wealthiest men in the world. And you forget when you talk to these people, they do it because it's the same thing that they fell in love with when they were young.
Yes.
It doesn't matter what the money and the success.
That's what motivates you in life. That's
yeah.
why you look forward to getting up yeah. in the morning.
Yeah, totally.
And, you know, what I, just like myself, I just can never scratch my itch enough for driving. You know, I keep driving those two-seaters or whatever, just to have some control, some, you know, involvement in some kind of race cars. And I'll be going to races until they put me in a box, obviously, because why? That's my life.
Yeah.
And
is it fun to see the people's reaction still, too? Because you're touching people who remember when you started.
But
Yeah, absolutely.
Just like, you know, going back to even the two-seater thing, there's no better way to showcase the sport, you know, to have someone, because they come away, even really staunch fans, you know, they know a little more about, oh my goodness, I didn't know it was like that, because it's such a non-participant sport, ours, you know, even you can go to driving schools or whatever, and you never go as fast as the diploma they give you.
No.
The diploma will say, you just did 164.7, and it was actually about 97.8.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So they, and these are, this is a satisfaction to see people really having some respect, if you will, and appreciation for what our sport is all about, what our drivers, you know, go through to be able to do it properly and all that. So, you know, all of that counts. I mean, yeah. I love the fans because, you know, our world would not exist without the fans, you know, and there's no bigger compliment to me than anyone just knowing something about even my career, you know, and you have to be, I mean, if you don't appreciate that, then you're not even human.
No. What, I know that you have a bucket list item coming up soon. I think you're going to drive something.
Yeah, I mean, it was last year. I was at Goodwood, and I sat in you know the McLaren Formula One car that was there, and Zach Brown, of course, you know he bought my for the '69, and I had driven it a few times, and I'm sitting there in a car. I said, "Man, I said, what would I give to drive this one?" Yeah. And he later on he said, "Well." He says, keep talking to me, you know.
Is that what he said?
And I didn't even talk to him much. But I didn't want to put him in a, you know, in a bit of a bind. You know,
it's like because when someone says, come and stay. You don't know how to call up and say, oh, I'm in town.
Yeah. And, but, you know, true to what he said, you know, I couldn't believe it. You know, he dropped this on me. He says, you're going to have to say it. I'm going to say it to you on live TV. And then it's, oh, my goodness, you know. And that's what it was. So now it looks like it's going to happen.
So what car will you drive?
Well, at first I thought it was going to be last year's car, but he says it's going to be a 2014. That was still going to be the hybrid era car.
Okay.
You know, so... And
I still think it'll fail pretty freaking quick.
Yeah.
I mean, it'll be...
So we'll be doing it at Laguna Seca first, and then he said we'll do it at Coda. I don't know how he got permission for that, but...
That's fantastic.
We'll see.
I saw Colton Herter at the BMW launch in LA of the LMDH. It looks good, all those cars, the new GTP prototypes.
Yeah.
I think we're in for a big heyday right now. You know, I said to John Doonan, president of IMSA, you know, NASCAR, IMSA, don't keep your fingers in your pockets here. Go full on, because I think the world's about to change a lot in the next 5-10 years.
Yes.
And, well, we all know that. And this
era.
Sort of era and the way the unification of the rules and these cars with the hybrid power plants, V8s, I mean, they're going to be... The car looks amazing. I mean, Lamborghini, everybody's in it.
Yeah.
Anyway, but Colton was there. Obviously, he's one of the drivers, and he was standing next to Brian. And, you know, they're so similar, right? They're just two guys that if you sat on a plane, you'd never know that they were, fast they were. And I didn't ask him about the license thing and everything, because that must just be very boring to him, really, and disappointing. But... I did ask about what it was like to drive a Formula One car.
His test. Yeah, Portimao, yeah.
Yeah, and he said the power.
He looked good.
I'd love to see the data, right? Wouldn't you like to see the heartbeat of their trace against...
I know the data.
Oh, you do?
It's impressive.
Is it? He's good, right? He could be good enough.
I'll tell you off camera.
Okay, you tell me off camera. But, you know, I just thought, you know, that is, you know, just hearing from a driver that how exciting it was, the sheer pleasure. But also, he was telling me, you know, whereas in IndyCar, you know, I remember Gilles de Ferran saying this, you know, you're in IndyCar, you might have four engineers. In Formula One, there's 14. You know, everything is a multiple of the same equation. But he just said it was, he said, you know, the trouble is the amount of data you have to consume.
Yeah.
Each the steering wheel... You know, all the settings, then have 10 more settings. Right. I mean, I think it's special. Do you like watching Formula One still?
Oh, I love to, of course.
Yeah. It's great now, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I'm in on all of them, all the majors. Number one, you know, more excite me more than others, you know, but Formula One forever, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it was my first love and will always be, regardless of the... you know, individuals that are running it right now. But the series, the racing, what it means, I mean, let's face it, it's the Olympics of motorsports.
It is.
And that's it. End of story. You're saying it all.
Yeah. I just think it's sad when anyone talks about adding so many races in other places. And how could you lose Spa? How could you lose Monaco? I mean, how could you lose Britain? You don't.
You lose that, you lose.
You lose. I mean, I think on their big fat spreadsheet, it shows they make more money when they do other races, other places. But
I know. Don't ever forget where it comes from.
No.
Where it came, where it all came from.
Also, that connection to history. People, I've never heard a driver say, I don't want to drive at Monaco. Yes, it's too tight, hard to overtake. But
all of it, but you want to be there.
But you want to be there. It's Spa. The craziest, I mean, the craziest series of corners maybe in the world that they still freaking love driving.
Right.
And I haven't been there since the sports car, so I went with Dad, but or actually since I raced there in the Viper. But just standing there in Eau Rouge, watching them go through, imagine what it even looks like now. I mean, they are flat as a kipper through there.
Yeah. Absolutely,
I love it. I think it's when we watch racing like that, it still sparks the same juvenile emotion, right?
Yes, absolutely, and it's always new. It's new excitement. It's never blasé.
No.
Never, not that.
No.
Not that type of a thing.
No.
So that's the beauty of it.
Do you think? I think
you never get enough of it.
Never get enough of it. Do you think that, and I know the answer is yes, but Mario Andretti starting out now, how would he do?
Well,
given opportunity and a lot of money.
I would hope that I would have the same passion.
Yeah.
You know, unless you're driven by passion, you know, nothing happens.
Yeah.
And I'll measure my passion for the sport against anyone on the planet ever.
Yeah.
I don't know anyone that loves the sport more than I do, and that's a fact.
My last thing before we finish is, I mean, you've got so many kids, grandkids. How many grandkids?
Seven.
And you are, I'm sure, you know, your words ring true for a lot of young drivers. But in life, if you could leave a message, if there was a motto, if there was a philosophy for life, what would yours be? Not just about racing, just about how to live as a man.
I always say, follow your dreams. Follow your dreams. And hopefully you have dreams young enough where you can pursue it. But if any young individual that has dreams early in life is going to be successful.
Thank you. Thank you, Mario. That was great. I really appreciate
it. My pleasure.
That's great. That was wonderful. It's good seeing all the pictures up on the wall. I was looking at them. Look at you and Fangio. And
yeah, Fangio. See that? Here we are. Jimmy and I at Indianapolis.
Yeah.
Do
you mind if I take a picture?
No, that's no.
Look at that. Look how young you both were.
Yeah. Look, when I first met Paul Newman, 1967, I had him sit in my car.
Look at that picture.
Aldo.
Jeez.
That's Jackie.
Yeah.
Presenting me the Formula One World Champion Trophy.
Oh, yeah. Look at that. That's Graham.
Yeah, Graham.
What was he like?
Graham. Great guy.
He was a good character, right?
Oh, God.
Yeah.
I love the guy. I mean, his sense of humor was
amazing. He must have been
amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing sense of humor.
Yeah, he must have been. Yeah. I mean, because Damon is...
He's
a quirky dude, too, right?
Yeah, he is.
I love it. Yeah. God, that's incredible. Do you sometimes look at these pictures? I mean, it's almost like another person. It's your life, but it's so incredible. Look at that. See Fangio there.
Yeah, we were in Stuttgart when... this is the 100th celebration of Mercedes.